This is Warbird Radio.
Hi, Matt Jolly here from WarbirdRadio.com, here to tell you about our new on-demand programming. Listen, we know your life's busy and you want to listen to your favorite shows when you have the time, not when they're being broadcast. Well, thanks to our new on-demand format, you can do just that. Just click on the on-demand button on the right side of WarbirdRadio.com and follow the simple instructions for setting up your favorite listening device. If you prefer to listen directly from WarbirdRadio.com, well, just click the Play Now button at the bottom of the show story. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy our new on-demand programming.
Hi, everybody. Join me, Nick Bezos, Smithsonian Curator, for Preserving Our Past, a lively look at air and space museums across the country. WarbirdRadio.com proudly presents our newest on-demand broadcast, Preserving Our Past, where museum experts share their thoughts and experiences for future generations of air and space museum lovers.
Log on now to FightingColors.com. That's FightingColors.com for more on Gary Velasco and his amazing nose art. That's FightingColors.com.
We've got your six. This is Warbird Radio. Tune in.
Take off.
And good evening, everybody. You're listening to another episode of the Warbird Rescue Hour, brought to you by our home here on Warbird Radio. I'm your host, Chris. With me always and would never leave my side is my cohort, Rob Morelli, but he's not here tonight. He is in the belly of a Corsair somewhere in North Dakota, and I'll get even with him. But luckily, I'm joined by two other friends this evening, and actually, it's this morning. I just lied on national radio. I'm joined by two other friends here, Adam White and Kara Martinelli. Thank you guys for coming on. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Oh, we're doing good. We're doing good. The sun's out this morning, so we're okay. And the Steelers won yesterday, so I'm doing all right. How'd your Browns do, Adam?
They had a match yesterday, and everyone enjoyed the hot dogs and environment.
Truth be told, I actually I do not hate the Browns.
You can't. You have to love them enough to hate them. It's the 14th year of their 1 year rebuilding season, so we'll see. Maybe number 15 will be exceptional.
Let's keep our fingers crossed, but it is. I will say this, you guys always manage to put together a good team and play us hard whenever the Steelers and the Browns play.
And we always provide a good, nice, young Texas quarterback for the Steelers to give a concussion to.
Oh, awesome. Love football season. Well, for those of you who don't know that are a fan of some of the best aviation documentaries out there right now, if you've seen Red Tail Reborn or if you've seen The Restorers, they were all volunteers. These are the guys that are responsible for those films, and fantastic films from Hemlock Films. And I'm not just saying that because they're friends or because they're on the radio. I actually owned two of the movies before I even met them. And if you haven't had a chance to check those out, please do. But today we're going to talk to Kara here for a few minutes about a book that she wrote. And it kind of doesn't do it justice to just call it a book, because it's not like you just sat down and created some characters and you wrote this book. There's a big story that goes into that. And tell us a little bit about this.
Well, the book is called My Very Dearest Anna, and I put it together. It's my grandparents' letters to each other during World War II. And the more I do book thing signings and events and stuff, I always say that, and I feel like it kind of loses what it is exactly. Because, it's a good way to summarize it, but it is, my grandpa was my best friend, and I learned about mostly about World War II through him because of, high school never really talked about it. It was more like a couple pages in a history book. But I didn't know about it until I was 18, and he kind of introduced me to that, and not because he was like, I want to talk about it. It was because I had a school project and I needed to interview someone. It was like, I don't know, grandpa. And he was like, I don't know, what do you want to talk about? And I was like, well, what'd you do? And so we kind of brought that up. And I was like, really? And so we kind of sat around and chatted about that. And the more he talked about it, the more I was fascinated. And he's the whole reason I'm even in this world of warbirds and airplanes and history because he just got me into it. And I spent all my time with him. So after he passed away, my mom said that I should have his letters. And I was like, I don't know, because I kind of like, he was a big part in my whole family. Like, he was very much loved by everybody. And the fact that my mom wanted to give them to me, I kind of felt like I had to do something with them. Like, I felt responsible. So I took those and I thought, hey, I'm just going to, you know, photocopy them and, you know, put them together and give them to the family. And then I was like, well, the more I talked about it with people, the more people were like, I want to read it. So it kind of developed into this book containing their letters and with me writing around it with my own experiences in the warbird community and relating that to what Grandpa went through. So I'm very blessed in being able to get to experience this stuff just because it's I get to experience what he experienced. So,
well, you know what? Let's touch on that for a second. You know, you get to know your grandfather really well, which is something that unfortunately a lot of people don't ever have the chance to do—to call their grandparents friends.
Yeah.
And that's that was something that really struck me as unique in the book. It reminded me of my grandparents. I had sort of a special relationship with them growing up, and a lot of kids don't have that chance. And then on top of it, then they never get to that level where they do talk about their experiences and find out, you know, what their grandparents, what their family roots sort of went through. And my family actually came here from Italy during World War II, actually right after World War II. And my grandparents were in a town that was invaded by Germans.
Wow.
And it has a pretty wild story about that. But how does it feel when you talk to your grandfather and you learn all these lessons – and then you find yourself flying around in a B-24, that has to be some sort of connection there that sort of maybe makes it go full circle, you know, that it really ties it all in.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's hard to describe because you just get this feeling in your gut. Like, I got to fly in a 24 briefly for maybe like 20 minutes because we were just doing a quick hop flight. One of the episodes of The Restorers that we were working on, we did Bomber Fantasy Camp with the Collins Foundation. So I got to ride in Wishcraft, and I told them that my grandfather was in a B-24 and a tail gunner, and they're like, you absolutely have to climb into the tail. And I was like, okay, I'll do that when I'm not shooting. In the 20 minutes I have. So while it was very brief that I got to go up in it, absolutely eye-opener what those guys felt in there. Like, the metal in there is so thin, and it's cold, and we weren't even that high, and you can see through where the ball turret is. Like, you can see a gap, and I was like, you can see Earth. Like, there's just, like, and they spent, like, 10 or plus hours in those things. You know, like, he flew across the Pacific in that to get out to the Philippines.
It's hard to believe.
Like, what? Like, but I mean, at the time, like, they probably didn't think that much of it. But I mean, by today's standards, it's just like its own. Like, I mean, it's a 70-year aircraft, so it's, you know,
people lose their minds today if they had to get in that.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's funny you touch on it. Everybody I've ever introduced to an airplane like that, the first thing out of their mouth is, wow, it's so the aluminum is so thin. Mm-hmm. You know, they always had this vision that it was all armor plating, and they just weren't like that. I think that's the comment I hear the most. So when we were working on the C-47, we had a lot of kids, maybe 13 to 16 or 17, who, you know, had played like Call of Duty video games and stuff where they jump out of a C-47 or had seen Band of Brothers. And when we were actually up on the C-47, they were like, oh my gosh, like, this is really thin. Like, you're really exposed.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's not a flying tank, you know?
Right. Exactly. Even they may be called the flying fortress or like the 17th flying fortress.
Exactly, yeah.
It certainly is not built to stop the flak and the bullets coming at you. So,
and that was the thick aircraft. You get a Japanese Zero and it's even worse.
Yeah, exactly. you know, I don't think the Zero, I don't think had self-sealing fuel tanks or anything like that.
No, if you whispered at it harshly, it would go down. Now, which made it a very, very maneuverable plane, and we just got to see one a week ago, but with Warren Peach flying it. But you can tell it had the maneuverability of a kite and also the durability of one.
Wow. Yeah, that it's a cool airplane, but yeah, you wouldn't want to take it in the wartime.
No, not at all.
It is the same with this B-17. I'm a B-17 nut, and you know, read about them my whole life, and then I got a chance to ride in a couple of them, and man, I mean, it is just an eye-opening event to get in there and go take it on a peacetime flight, and it's like, this is crazy. I couldn't imagine going to war in this thing. Like you said, you can look down where the ball turret is, and you can see, you know, the Earth passing by, and you know, in my head, I guess I always thought everything was sealed up tight.
Yeah.
Crossing the catwalk on the Bombay, you can look down and see, you know, cities and stuff going by.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is the Bombay is nuts. It's like, how they fit through here, and it's like, and if you fell, like,
yeah. A briefing I got on Sentimental Journey was, don't fall on the Bombay's doors because they'll just open and you'll fall out.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, okay, I'm pretty determined not to do that. So. But, yeah, I mean, it's that level of, you know, and there was stuff, at least on the 17, I'm not sure about the B-24, but there were things for the crew members to actually do in the Bombay on that catwalk, along with, you know, not just arming the bombs, but there were actual manual cranks and pumps and stuff in there. Jeez. And to just be kind of hanging out on that catwalk, it's a little crazy.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't think a lot of people realize what they actually went through. Like, it's like, oh, you flew up in that? Okay. You know? Like,
yeah, the way they outfitted people on that is they couldn't armor every square inch of it because it would make it, you know, it'd lose its range and carry less bomb load. It's more akin to thinking of it carried a bunch of guys in spacesuits because you couldn't do that to the whole plane. But what you had was a platform to carry bombs, and then all of the crew members had their own heating suits, their own oxygen, and their own armor plating with their flak jackets. So instead of armoring and sealing up the entire plane at that time, like which they did on the later aircraft, they just, you know, just armored up and basically put guys in 1941 spacesuits.
Yeah, I've never heard it broken down that way, but that's a very good that's a very good way of doing it. That and by the way, Adam, I gotta ask, for those who don't know, Adam and Kara were just married here shortly a little while ago. And Adam, it has to get you fired up to have your new wife call it not a B-24, but just the 24. You know, that's, you know, like an old war vet. That's pretty cool. I picked up on that a few seconds ago, and I'm like, she just called it a 24. Like, that's pretty neat.
She has more experience in it than probably 90% of people that ever go to air shows. You know, when we're shooting the episode and she come and the 24 is coming to park, and she's the one that's sticking out the top to call out the clearances on the wings. There's not a lot of old dudes out there that can say they've done that, much less females that are excited to guide that giant wing up the canyon of a airport.
Yeah, that was actually pretty impressive. Told me to get up there, and I was like, really? And I thought it was fine. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And Adam said, he goes, I saw you, like, wheeling up, and I saw someone standing up there. And he's like, as it got closer, he's like, I think that's Kara.
That's awesome.
He's like Patton wheeling into the bulge.
Yeah. I always like there's no way of not making that look cool, by the way. Just sitting up on top of the B-24 as it's running and taxiing in. You know, I think even, like, the nerdiest of dudes can make that look cool.
Exactly. Yeah, that's, like, the cool seat.
Absolutely. Well, now, so you got the letters to write this book, and, you know, how did that all start as far as, you know, how did you feel sort of diving into these letters? It had to be sort of an adventure in its own.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really tough. You know, I had those, she gave them to me the year he passed away, which was 07, I believe, and it took me years to actually, like, it just sat on my shelf. I was like, I have this amazing treasure, and I don't want to look at it because it was way too upsetting for me. I don't know. Like, it was the last of Grandpa that, you know, like that I would hear of his conversation. And I really didn't want to do it because it's like, once that's done, it's done. Like, there's no more. So it took me a couple of years to get around to it. And I finally was like, you know, I really want to do this. So I'm going to do it. And I took him out actually into the backyard underneath. Our old house had this big tree. And I sat under the tree and started reading it. And I just, like, of course, just started bawling. Like, I was like, this is really hard. So it took me a while to really just remove myself from who it actually was and just read the story. Because after I did that, you know, like, they sort of developed into these, like you had mentioned before, there are these characters that, and then you can start relating to them. And it's weird to read something that you're, you know, like your grandfather, when you only know him as an older person. And reading what his thoughts were when he was 18, it's kind of bizarre, but it's funny because a lot of the stuff he wrote in there, I was like, he talked like that. You know? Like, he would say that phrase all the time. And it was really sweet because it was a little way for me to sort of get through it. And the book has been very much a way for me to say goodbye because I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to him. So it's been a little bit of therapy for me, I guess. But it's been, reading them was definitely one of the best things I've ever gotten to do.
It's fantastic. And by the way, for those that are just tuning in and don't know, we are talking to Adam White and Kara Martinelli and talking about the book My Very Dearest Anna, which are actually it's a book put together of the love letters that went back and forth between two people that became her grandparents during World War II. And your grandfather flew the B-20, well, he was a tail gunner on B-24s in the Pacific, right?
Yes.
And he went on how many combat missions again?
He only made 5 missions. He actually was supposed to go on a mission the day they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Because he would tell me was that he had a mission. They had their 6th mission scheduled for that morning on August 6th. And he said that they had a briefing the night before. And they said that there's probably going to be about 500 anti-aircraft guns aimed at you, you know, once. So,
wow.
which I was like, that sounds like a lot. But, they were going to be invading the island of Japan, which he never said, but I would only assume that's what he was going
that
to.
That could be
at
the only
point.
Place that would have that much artillery.
And they were just like, good luck, essentially. Like, they're like, you're probably not coming back from this. So that morning he woke up and there was a notice posted on the board that all missions were scrapped. And they didn't know why until later, and it was because they dropped the bomb. And he would always say, as awful as that was, we probably wouldn't be here if it weren't for that. So he joined towards the end of the war. He actually joined in 1944, and the letters start when he goes to training. So it follows his training until he comes back.
I thought it was interesting. Yeah, it literally goes from his training missions, and it's kind of neat how you follow him to all of these sort of outposts along the way as he's, you know, transferring the aircraft to their unit. Mm-hmm. And also, I made note that it took him only like a day from the time he got back to the time that he went and found Anna. he wasn't going to waste any time after writing letters all that time. I thought that was really interesting. It was like a day. It was like, that's it. I'm, you know.
Yeah, he's like, I'm home. I'm going to go get her.
Yep. And they were married shortly after that, right?
Yeah, they were. I think it was maybe, I think he came back in March or April, and they got married in May. And they started dating, like he asked her out on a date right before he left for war because he always liked her and never asked her out and thought, I'm going off to war. I should do this. So, and they promised to write to each other. So like, essentially that's their courtship. Like, all the letters are how they got to, you know, I mean, they knew each other because they were friends for years, but, like, she dated his cousin, which he absolutely
hated. Oh, that was a sore spot. I know that. Read the book. Yeah. He was still sore about that.
Oh, yeah. You, like, just talk about it. He would just, like, I love that. Like, I've never heard anyone talk so sweetly about somebody in my entire life. So, like, it's unfortunately for Adam, he had a lot to measure up to because that's what I thought men are supposed to be like. So, I'm, like, supposed to adore you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, hey, look, Adam took you for a nice stay in a resort that had underground stay and deer heads on the wall. So, I mean, really, I mean, what more could you ask for?
That was a lovely, lovely home.
Our underground Oshkosh lair, as we call it, is very wild. I love, by the way, I have a picture of all of us together, and the look on Adam's face is priceless because behind him is a wall full of deer heads. So, it's just a fantastic picture. But no, you know, absolutely, I think that spending time with you guys, that is still there. That type of relationship is obviously there between you two, and it's awesome to see. Yeah. And then you read the book and you see where some of it comes from, and it's just very cool. And for those that are that haven't read the book, pick it up because it is a really great book. It's not just the typical, you know, on this date these guys bombed this target. It's a first person view of the war, and you know, it's a side that you don't get to see very much, which is sort of interaction and letters home with someone on the home front. That's not a side of the war that we see a ton of.
Yeah, absolutely. Because like you, I love to read. I love to read, and the majority of my books are World War II nonfiction because I want to learn more about it. And those are my favorite that I find is when they're about one particular individual. And I love reading books about letters. Like, I'm reading one right now from a WASP, and I can't gush about it enough. Like, it's just something to hear from somebody who lived a part of history, like such a huge part of history, and like you get to hear their like firsthand account while they were doing it. So
it's very interesting. It's also interesting to see how not that I necessarily agree with this statement, but a book that I just finished reading the other day about a B-17 top turret gunner, and you know, to all of us, the Doolittle raid is epic, and it's interesting to see how history has painted things a different way. This top turret gunner was like, yeah, we knew Doolittle, we viewed the Doolittle raid as sort of a publicity stunt, you know, and it's like, what? You know, and then now but this was written 30 years ago, you know, and from a guy who was a top turret gunner, and it's interesting to see how, you know, some of those guys viewed those things, where to us, we would never dare think that. I mean, that, you know.
I'm sure that came from a lot of guys, you know, when they were in the probably in the trenches every day. And we all know that the Doolittle raid didn't really hit any targets of value, at least in any concrete way. And I'm sure the guys that were having missions every day and going out there and facing either the Japanese Air Force or the Luftwaffe daily, they probably did view it as a publicity stunt. Like, how much anti-aircraft fire did Doolittle and his boys ever run into? And they just sat on a Navy ship for most of their mission. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the minds of an 18-year-old when you're looking at and we've spoken to so many current serving veterans, and there's the good natured competition between branches of the service or even companies of men within a division, that you look at those guys don't really do anything. We're not soldiers, we're Marines. And all of that, I'm sure, still existed back then. When you're an 18-year-old and these guys are getting the Medal of Honor and are heralded as heroes, it's like, what? They didn't hit anything.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very interesting. I always tell everybody, and it sort of goes along with that, if you have a chance to sit down and get to talk to a veteran, no matter which conflict, do it, because that is the best history lesson on that subject you'll ever have.
Yeah, absolutely. That's my favorite, one of my favorite things to do is just to sit and listen. And, like, they love it. They love to be, you know, like, I mean, not all of them particularly love to talk about their experience, but like, I think it's nice that they, I mean, like, they just like someone listening to them, which is sort of heartbreaking in its own. Like, it's like everybody should give them rapt attention all the time. Because, I mean, like, and I'm going to rail into my old woman mode right now. Because I, you know, like, you see all the kids out there, like, buried in their phones and their video games. And it's like, they don't pay any attention and they don't care. So it's like, I think they really appreciate when a younger audience is into what they did, in a way, I guess.
And the well is so deep in the stories. We went to the Houston Wins Over Houston Air Show, and we were interviewing veterans there for very little other reason than to get those stories down. And we were interviewing a Mustang pilot from the Pacific. And Chris, I know you've talked to one or two veterans in your day, and so have I. And I had never heard this story before of this Mustang pilot. And when they were at Iwo Jima, they're at the one air base just waiting for the Marines to get the other air base to secure it. And it was a daily struggle. And they finally sort of secured the air base, and they moved their Mustangs onto that base at Iwo. And then the Japanese attacked him, and he was involved. He's one of the few Mustang pilots that ended up in a ground battle with the Japanese.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've never heard about that.
And so him and his buddies are laying in their tent. They had a revolver hanging at the top of the tent, but if they sat up to get it, the Japanese could shoot him. So they're sort of laying flat in their tent to avoid enemy fire at that point.
Oh, wow. Could you imagine? I mean, it's one thing to be a combat pilot. It's another thing to actually be in combat on the ground.
Yeah, especially when they weren't, like, trained for that, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, they're not expecting to be in that.
Yeah.
You know, that, and that's exactly, you know, you hit the nail on the head. If we don't make an attempt with the limited time we have left with, especially the World War II vets, mm-hmm. And let's not forget the Korean vets. I mean, a lot of those guys were leftovers from World War II, you know, had been serving during World War II and just never got out or came back. You know, we just lost Boots Blasé a few days ago. And, you know, so let's not forget those guys. But unless we make the most of the time we have left with them, you know, we're really going to be missing out on a big history lesson and and we can't depend – not a knock on schools, but – you know, World War II is, I think, two pages in a history book right now.
Exactly. And it's like once they're gone, they're gone. So it's like you got to get it before. And that's another reason I wanted to do this is because a lot with my signings, people come up and will say, you know, I have these letters like from my dad or my uncle or and they're like, oh, I should do something with them. And I was like, absolutely. Like, preserve that.
Yeah.
Like,
I've gotten calls before people – they opened up a crate of letters and photographs, and they just called me because they had seen The Restorers or Red Tail Reborn on PBS and said, what do you think I should do with that? And I was like, call the Air Force Museum. Put them somewhere where the appreciation and the preservation can happen. And with people like that, it was too late to talk to their grandfather or father at that point. But people want to do something or just kind of unclear on what to do with it. And you look at the most famous of stories that are out there. You look at the Hap Arnolds or the Wasps or even the Tuskegee Airmen, and is there work still to be done? And even with George Lucas making his film last year, it's still 90% of Americans don't know what the words Tuskegee Airmen are. And that's probably one of the most famous group of veterans at this point. Everyone else is even lesser known.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have heard rumor going, Band of Brothers in the Pacific were done, so we covered it, right? And not by a long shot. And I had heard rumor that Hanks and Spielberg are working on a project about the air war in the Pacific. I don't know if that's absolutely true or not, but I more than welcome it.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome. I hope they do. And you're right, you know, just because, you know, Band of Brothers is fantastic. I mean, that is – Band of Brothers really set a bar high for films to and miniseries to reach. But like you said, that was one unit. That was one unit's view of the war. It did a great job of telling, you know, a pretty good story, but that doesn't tie it up and say, well, that's it, we're done with that. You know, it's like, well, no, there's a lot of other stories to come out of just that area, and you know, in the European theater, and same with the Pacific, and same with, you know, so many different aspects of that war. And, you know, the biggest thing right now, my big thing is I wish every history teacher would just take a week and show Band of Brothers. I mean,
yeah.
That would be better than basically reading in a history book right now. It's you've got video of the actual veterans and you know, them telling their story. And you know, Band of Brothers did it right. You know, I mean, they did a good job on it. And, you know, we'll hold judgment on some of the others. But, you know, another thing is they could get a hold of maybe they were all volunteers or, you know, Red Tails, you know, the Red Tail Reborn. And, you know, those are great because they tell a story of an airplane and of a warbird, but then it also tells why they're doing this. Why do people go out and volunteer weekends on these things? What's the big deal? You know, because to a lot of people, it's like, oh, that's cool, just an old airplane, just like seeing like a 65 Mustang somewhere. And it's like, well, no, it's not. You know, there's a big, big reason why it's important these airplanes continue to be restored and flown. And, you know, I think your films definitely explain that. I think somebody coming off the street can watch it and say, oh, that's why we need to do this.
Well, yeah, the aircraft are all just aluminum scrap that we keep going and keep functioning. And the only reason to do that is that they are a symbol for the stories and the people that were involved with that. And that's the only reason that we film the people and their stories. If we just wanted to film rare aircraft, we'd just make a whole series of going through the Smithsonian. Which has its value in a particular way. But what interests us is the story of a bunch of people who, whether they have good means or they don't have good means, whether they're a check writer for warbirds or that they volunteer all of their time to punch rivets, there's a reason why. And that's the crux of why we tell the stories that we do, is why do these people do this? And that's what interests us. And a lot of people, when they watch our material, they're kind of surprised by it. Say, wow, there was something more to that. Now, they pop Red Tail Reborn in and say, oh, it's going to be a history lesson in the Tuskegee Airmen. And your eyes already start getting sleepy when you hear documentary because you think of eighth grade and there's going to be just the whirl of a projector in the back of the room. Kids, film documentaries used to be on film. So that's an old man's reference. And when people watch it, they go, there's something else here. When you hear the story of told by the airmen on one hand, and then also the story of the Hines family, which there's many, many other people who restored that airplane or helped restore that airplane and restore others out there. But they're sort of an example of the dedication that is out there that people feel to tell these stories, to tell a history. And our biggest question when we go into these projects is why.
Yeah, like where does that passion come from and why is it important? And, you know, like, and then one of the major answers we always get is that phrase is like, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. And
even the positives. Now, it doesn't have to be a mistake like, oh, right. We let Hitler happen. It doesn't have to be the worst of mistakes that we have to learn from. It could be the triumphs of. The triumph of the Tuskegee Airmen overcoming what they had to do, the perseverance of the Wasps in saying, I'm going to fly the dumb thing anyway, whether you want me to or not, or just the engineering triumphs of what can happen when we're forced into a bottleneck of conflict and what people can bring together. And you look at the path of aircraft before World War II, we had biplanes, and we had, I can't remember, it's like the 14th biggest army or biggest air force in the world behind Bolivia. And then after World War II, just a couple of short years, we broke the sound barrier.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, the thing, the fact that always amazed me was they said that prior to 1941, that during an air display in Germany, the German Luftwaffe had put up more aircraft at this air show than the United States had in its entire inventory of both the Air Force and the Navy.
Yeah.
And, well, of course, then the Army. But still, you know, think about that. They had more airplanes up at one air display than we had total. I mean, you know, and obviously when the war broke out, you know, that was how we fought. I mean, not all of our aircraft were better than the military, the Germans or the Japanese. However, we would just keep punching them out. I mean, we just mass-produced ourselves into victory. I mean, look at the Sherman tank. The Sherman tank is an okay tank. But yet it's legendary because it, you know, we were just able to make so many of them and get so many mobilized and over there that we overwhelmed a tank like the Panzer, which was probably a better tank.
Yeah, it has always been said that the first Gulf War in 91 was actually the very first conflict we ever went into prepared.
That sounds about right. Yeah. I have a veteran or friend. I'm sorry, a friend of the family that's a veteran who flew at the first run-in in Vietnam, that I Trang Valley, and he doesn't feel they were prepared, obviously.
Yeah.
So for everything that happened there, but yeah, that sounds about right. You know, and you know, you touch on something else that was good, that the people that do this, the people that go out there and work on the airplanes and restore them, and don't, you know, and what you guys do, I mean, it takes a lot of dedication, and it also becomes part of you. I mean, you know, Jim and Amy were literally, they met working on a B-25, and they got married in front of that B-25. And you guys got married at the MAPS Air Museum, right?
Yeah.
You know, that it becomes part of you. It becomes, you know, well, why wouldn't we be doing this at the Air Museum with our friends? You know, like, this is where we belong, you know. And, you know, there's definitely a side of that, you know, once you open that door and you see what's out there, it's like, wow, this is where I belong. This is more than just a history lesson. It's doing something else. And hopefully others are going to be able to, you know, to walk away with something out of this that, like, oh, yeah, that was important what those guys did. So.
And people have a vague sense that they want to belong. When you brought up our wedding, we had, you know, people who have worked on our projects and also people who had no real sense of them either, and they said that this was the best wedding that they had ever been to. And we didn't have trapeze artists or anything. We just had the reception in a hangar with a bunch of warbirds.
Yeah.
And I think it very much is a case that a lot of people just don't have the exposure to it. Because Karen, I, and you, Chris, are not normal people. You know, we're involved with this day to day, and we know, way more about this than we should. And, regular people don't know that Oshkosh exists. They don't know that the Reno Air Race exist, much less the smaller, or one-time run events like the Doolittle event. And the biggest thing anybody can ever do, I think, is to not go find your warbird buddy to take to an event, but you find somebody that has absolutely no experience in it and take them to one of these events and let them, you know, you might let them catch the bug a little bit, just a little bit, and that might be all that it takes to grow the community.
Well, yeah, I've totally infected my buddy down the street. So he is he was interested in airplanes as far as if there's a History Channel documentary on, he'd watch it, but that was about it. And I basically started taking him out to the local airport, but not, you know, when people hear airport, they think of gates and tugs, and, you know, this is the little General Aviation Airport. And he's now the proud owner of a 1947 Stetson.
Nice.
So,
yeah, so he's he's totally infected, and he went to Oshkosh with us last year, and you know, he's like, I had no idea this existed. He goes, this is insane. And so he thought, you know, he's like, oh, people are gonna laugh at me because I have this old Stetson, and then there's, you know, there's like eight others parked there. He's like, this is amazing. So,
there is a place on this earth for everyone.
Yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, introducing, Adam's introduced me to this entire world. Like, I've always been into it, and I didn't know about Oshkosh. Like, I didn't know that people did this. I mean, at most, like, I saw the Collins Foundation would come to Olympia, Washington when I lived there, and we would go look at the planes, and that was it. So, like, and I love that stuff. Like, I was knee-deep in reading books about it, and I didn't know there was a community out there. So it's actually been a great last 4 years knowing about this stuff.
Yes, we took you from not knowing about AVA. Adam took you from not knowing anything about Oshkosh to sleeping in an underground bunker filled with spearheads.
I think it's just beginning.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to have to put a picture up of the place just so people can understand what exactly the interior of our house looks like up there. But we didn't decorate it. We just stayed there.
Andrew and Uncle Owen did a lot to that place. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, Adam and Kara, thank you so much for being on, and we really appreciate everything that you guys are doing for the Warbird community and for the veterans, because you guys do a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate being on, and if people wanted to find out about the book, they could go to DearestAnna.com, and you can look all about how to purchase the book and also the added bonus material that Kara's put on there.
Yeah, I put a lot of photos and stuff that weren't able to make it into the book, so there's a little extra stuff that you can go look at there, too. Yeah, and Christmas is coming up. It always makes a good present.
Absolutely. Book, and
5 or 6 DVDs.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Adam, where can they pick up some of your DVDs at?
You can go to flightcinema.com, and you can pick up all of the movie titles that we have on DVD and or Blu-ray.
Oh, nice. Oh, nice.
And the other thing we've been working on is our Restorer series, which we just got another investor check this week, which is very exciting. But we certainly need more. So if anybody's interested in talking about that, we contact us through the Hemlock website as well.
And I can't stress to you guys enough, if there's anybody out there that's on the fence about it, that to pick up one of these movies and check it out or read the book, either one is very powerful. It's not just the same run-of-the-mill book and DVD. It's really, really great. And I will go on record as saying I prefer to watch Red Tail Reborn over Red Tail. So and that is not a lie. So
that's the first time we have heard that.
Now, you guys, I think what makes your projects different is they come from the heart, and that really is when you're passionate about something. Obviously, you excel at it. So you guys are doing wonderful things, and you really are doing wonderful things for wonderful people. Veterans are getting attention that they wouldn't otherwise be getting. And so our hat is off to both of you. And we wish you guys good luck in your future endeavors, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Talk to you guys later.
All right. Bye, Chris.
See you later.